Blog Talk Radio.
Blog Talk Radio and the Cosmic Citizen. My name is Paula Thompson. I'm your host, and with me today are my two dear friends and co-hosts, Chuck Thurston and Pamela Chaddock. Hi, you guys.
Yes. Hi, Paula. Hello,
good
Chuck.
Good morning.
Yes, good morning.
Hi, Chuck. Are you there? Chuck? I see him, I think. I see him on the board, but I don't hear you, Chuck. So maybe you're still on mute. Anyway, welcome, friends.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry. Okay.
Can you hear me now?
No worries. Yeah, I can hear you now. There
okay,
he is.
Yeah, I was on mute.
There's
sorry.
The indelible Chuck Thurston. No.
Can you hear me?
Glad to hear your
morning.
Voice.
Morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Pam.
Yes, good morning, Chuck.
So it's just us three. I think there's a general council meeting today. And Andre, of course, is on the fellowship's general council. And that's from 10 to 6. So he may already be on it, actually, listening to that. And Marvin is visiting his family. And I believe he's in Oregon. Maybe Washington. I'm not sure. They said they stopped by here in Colorado. We had a great lunch with he and Francel, his wife, his lovely and talented wife. And our listeners may remember that if they've been listening for a long, long time. We used to play a lot of Francel Gowron's music, Francel Striano Gowron, and at the beginning of the show. And yeah, Francel is a very talented musician in her own right, singer, songwriter. Wow. She's just incredible. I'm a big fan of Francel.
Yeah, it was great to see her.
Yeah, she's great. Miss her, you know, miss seeing her and hearing her music a lot. And, you know, seeing her at conferences and stuff. She got deeply involved with work at a Christian church, and so she hasn't been able to. She hasn't had a lot of time, but it's always a delight to see Francel. So anyway, my friends, we are back. It feels so good to be back. It feels like I've been away for a long time. I was at a woman's retreat last weekend, in the San Francisco area. Well, Menlo Park, which is 30 minutes south of San Francisco and about that far north of San Jose. So beautiful area. Man, Chuck, I bet you missed that part of California.
Oh, yeah.
It's so beautiful there. Gosh,
yeah,
the weather was, yeah, it's special. There's a feeling in the air. You know, I can see why people love the Pacific Northwest because when it's beautiful, it's just ethereal almost. It's that kind of beauty gives you a feeling in your heart that's just superb.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah,
that, so it was nice to be there with, I was with 25 remarkable women. Chuck probably know, you and Chuck both probably know all of them well. There was only a couple new newbies there to the group, but the presentations were outstanding. And I was telling Pam before the show, it was women, you know, just like men, when men get together in a group by themselves, they can open up in ways that they can't necessarily do when women are present. And the same is true with women. When women are together in a group, we open up in ways that we couldn't necessarily do if men were present. And so a woman's retreat is really a special kind of ministry. Women minister in a special way to other women. And it was very rich. So I feel replenished.
Mm-hmm. That's great. That's great.
So glad to be
so
here.
So perfect. Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. You were missed.
Aw, thanks. Yeah, I missed you guys too.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love our Saturday morning study. And you know, it's just about as good as it gets for me. But it was great to be at that retreat. I highly recommend retreats. Just an intensive way to replenish, to recharge your battery.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot going on in the world, and I think we need we need that, you know. So anyway,
yeah,
we are in
a minute.
Yeah.
Well,
right.
Chuck, you were on the road, weren't you, last week?
I was. Yeah, I was in Phoenix actually last weekend.
Oh,
you were?
Oh,
what were you doing in Phoenix?
Uh-huh. Oh, they invited me to give a presentation.
Oh, so your annual. Gold or their Grand Canyon Society. Yay.
That's
a fun one. Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
I think it's on their anniversary. Yeah.
Hmm.
Neat.
I mean, it wasn't a huge gathering. It was intimate. It was fun. I gave the workshop, my workshop from the last summer study session about
the
principles and practices. No, about principles and practices. Yeah,
oh,
Melchizedek
wow.
was a couple years ago.
Yeah, right.
Principles and practices.
Principles and practices, yes.
Mm. Oh, nice.
For, you know, for growing in the kingdom. For all that good
right.
stuff.
Right. Yeah, you know, we talked about that a lot at the retreat, too, and we really looked at in depth how the Urantia book says women are the spiritual torchbearers and the moral standard bearers. And we really looked and said, what does that mean to us? You know, what does that mean? You know, and really had a great in-depth study because, of course, we were there, you know, we were looking at that for 3 days pretty much and the ramifications of that, our responsibilities in the world. So that was... That was pretty cool to do that. I went
and
to
the rocks the cradle.
Fraternizes with destiny.
That's great.
So it's like the first disclosure, right? The very first disclosure of parental love is such an opportunity women have to change the world by being important in the lives of their children.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's pretty neat to think about all of that. And I wanted to say that, you know, Chuck, I have had the singular joy and experience of traveling all over the country and meeting all the various Urantia groups, not all of them, but many of them, as we've come together to do outreach at various expos.
Right, yeah.
And, I did that for probably 17 straight years. I traveled around, and I got to meet all of the Urantia societies. And I love Phoenix. There's that the Arizona group is such a remarkable. Everyone is so remarkable, and each one reflects the different location they're in. You know,
mm-hmm.
So that was a joy. I'm glad to know you were with them.
Uh-huh.
We had a couple of gatherings. Yeah, sorry. Phoenix was a gathering place for a couple of the emergent church conferences. And quite a number of the locals showed up for that. And it's very energizing. There's always so much being congealed when that group participates in anything you're doing. It's a good, solid group. It's probably one of the oldest societies.
It's a solid group.
I don't know.
Really solid.
We had a great concert with Ruthie Weiner. And
she's amazing.
From Colorado. He flew in also. So that was wonderful.
Yeah, Dick and Peggy Johnson were instrumental in solidifying that group, and a remarkable couple. I was with their daughter at the woman's retreat, Karen Allen.
Oh, really?
And it was great to be with her, and, you know, we think about multiple generations of the Urantia book readers who have, you know, carried on. Neat to think about. Wonderful to think about, actually. She's such a sweet person. I was telling Pam Chuck before we came on that there were, out of 25 women, there were 6 that have lost a son in his 30s or younger. And
wow.
So we had a special memorial. Yeah, it's shocking. You know?
Well, yeah, tragic. Really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we got in touch with, you know, the hand that rocks the cradle in a big way, and our responsibility for bringing life into the world. And it was poignant. Christina, we did a special memorial for them and for Sarah Blackstock as well. Sarah has been such a wonderful servant in the Urantia community, and she served children. Ironically, that's who she served. She served our children for years.
Mm-hmm.
She created an event at our conferences that they could join into and enjoy, and had so much fun doing. The event was called the Jerusalem Marketplace. She literally recreated a Jerusalem marketplace for the children of our community, and she did that for many, many years and or many conferences. And so we had a memorial for her as well. She died on April 8th, the eclipse day. It was still pretty raw. That's
auspicious.
Well,
yeah,
auspicious. Yeah, what an ascension.
Or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
Right.
I don't know.
Right. And I was there. I was at the Bald Knob Cross of Peace for the eclipse. That was quite an adventure.
That was a delightful experience
with Derek and Larry Geis and Sue Haskell and me, and then Trudy and Eric Cooper both showed up, and several groups of Urantians showed up, some from San Francisco, Chuck, that used to study with Larry Geis, Morgan, and her children.
I remember Morgan,
You remember Morgan? I think her last name is...
Sure.
Yeah, her daughter Stina and her, several of her daughters.
Mm-hmm.
Gabby.
I remember when they were babies.
Yeah, right, right. So it was really neat that, you know, Judy and Eric showed up with a big circle flag, and we posted that flag in our little area, and next thing you know, your Ranch and Boat Readers were coming up. Of course, Halbert was there. He had his shofar, and, you know, it was just quite an experience. I don't think I'll ever forget it as long as I live. And I got to say that the eclipse was spectacular. Sue likes to point out it was a miracle that that whole path, except for Buffalo, I guess. I don't know how Buffalo got left out, but the whole path just cleared up. And the totality was visible for everybody in that line of totality.
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting? Except
well, what I heard there was rain. The rain the day before and the rain the day after.
Yeah.
Where you were.
Right. Yeah. And Sue just was thrilled by that. And it actually got up to 80 degrees that day. But the eclipse itself was amazing. The corona, being able to see it, you just take off your glasses and then look at it with your naked eye. You know, after when it was in totality, you can take your glasses off and you can see that beautiful corona all around. It's just such a stunning thing to see.
Oh, yes.
But then
on a dark
the light
sky,
came back.
You know.
Yeah. What was really interesting was there was a sunrise all the way around us. That was an interesting phenomenon. Because we were in the mountains and we could see the sun rising in the entire circle.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it looked like.
Outside
anyway.
The totality.
It looked like a dawn.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
then
like a halo.
The light.
Oh, how beautiful.
Yeah.
Oh.
It was really amazing.
Wow.
And when the light came back, it was the purest light I've ever seen.
Oh,
I couldn't get over it. It's like, and I kept saying to people, "Do you see this? This is like everything's in high def. Look at this.
Mm.
It is the purest light I've ever seen. It was just pure. Like I don't know. I can't even describe it. It was really cool. So I was glad I was there.
Yeah. Well, even on the live stream. What's that? Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, even on the live stream, you know, I watched a lot of it on the live stream that Derek was doing. It was pretty dramatic to watch the darkness roll over the landscape. You know, you can sort of see it coming from a distance. It's getting darker and darker. And it just swept over. I mean, that was crazy. Very dramatic.
Yeah. Very dramatic.
Can you imagine
here we were.
Felt, you know?
Oh, yeah. You can see why they would get all superstitious and afraid.
They
didn't have science. Yeah, they didn't have science to help them understand what was happening.
They didn't know what was going on,
Yeah. But,
they
can't avoid
religious.
It.
Religious real fast, didn't they?
Yeah, you know, that's not why we were there. We were there because it was auspicious that there were two coincidences around the two eclipses that happened 7 years apart. The first one was on Jesus' birthday. The second one was on April 8th, which technically is the time of the tomb when he was in the tomb. And, you know, that's just pretty cool. Those are some cool coincidences right there.
Yeah,
and we thought it was
a
great opportunity to bring attention to this book that highlights those coincidence, you know, those dates as being very significant in the life of Jesus. And what we didn't know what to expect, but for the most part, I mean, there was nothing, there was about 1,500 people there. The cross is spectacular, Chuck. You could probably see it in you too, Pam, from looking, you know, from the pictures Derek caught. Derek was able to get some amazing pictures. And he was able to launch his drone. Nobody bugged him. Nobody bothered him. There's another guy there doing drone footage. He was so worried about that, I think, that someone was going to come up and get in his face and say, no, you can't do that. And, of course, he wouldn't have done it then. But nobody was punitive there or heavy-handed. It was like a festival. Everybody was gathered on the grass around the cross. Everyone was happy, jovial. Pretty, really nice place to see the total eclipse.
I'll bet.
At the foot of a 100-foot cross like that. So,
I guess.
And to know the story.
Yeah.
So that was fun. Well, I missed you guys, but that was fun.
It impacted so many Americans. I mean, what a phenomenon. You know, you can't help but think, you know, all across our land, how people were impacted by it on subtle levels, you know, that, I don't know, it's it was pretty unique to affect that many Americans all at, you know, all in the same day. And, you know, it had to be healing on a lot of levels, you know, when you think of the trauma and the confusion that we're going through, something like that just really gives you a chance to have a new perspective, you know, a new framework. So, yeah, it's probably one of those things we won't be able to identify, but we know that millions of Americans have been touched by it. So.
Right. You know, one thing that occurred to me was everyone was looking on.
Yeah.
It seems silly, right? But it's just everyone's looking up. How great is that? We're looking up, which we should do. We should look up. And you know, which is a great segue into what we're going to read and what we've been reading and what we always read in the Urantia book. If the Urantia book doesn't give you a reason to look up, nothing will.
Yeah, you know?
Honestly, I can't
look up,
imagine.
Look in.
Yeah, look up and look in. Good point.
Mm-hmm.
And realize that we are surrounded. You know, I guess more and more it dawns on me that the tragedy of our world is that we don't know what's all available to us and how beautiful the universe is, how friendly, how well organized, how loving, how willing and ready it is to receive us, you know, with open hearts. And we think we just rack ourselves with fear because we don't, you know, we think we don't know. It's astonishing to me that, you know, how afraid we are and how... Mm-hmm. You know, troubled when everything is on our side. It's like Jesus told Fortune on the hillside, right? The real things of this world and the universe are on your side. You know?
Yes.
Look up, young man. Look around. Realize you're wasting your time sitting up here on the hillside feeling sorry for yourself. Go down and live your life as a man among men. You know, I just love that. That's probably one of my very, very favorite sections.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's a great one.
Yeah. It is.
Well, just going back to the eclipse for a second, though, I mean, imagine what it must have been like in ancient times. You know, and they were so dependent on the sun. You know, the sun was like life, the life force, you know, that provided all their agriculture and their life and everything. And to see it go away like that, I mean, talk about being afraid. Talk about something scary. That must have been so intense, you know. And, of course, it'd come back, right? Still, for those few moments, as you can just imagine what a thing that must have been. So I kind of wonder, you know, experiencing the eclipse even now maybe brings up some of those deeply rooted, you know, ancestral memories or something of realizing how dependent we really are on the sun and how glad we are when it comes back. I mean, it didn't really go away, but still, there's a psychological or something there that almost touches something deep and profound there beyond
absolutely.
Just the phenomenon. Beyond the astronomical reality of the eclipse, which is cool in itself, but the sort of metaphorical and, you know, well, like Jesus, you know, the light of the world. You know, there's a being on the hill with the cross. There's an interesting kind of combination there too. You know, we don't want the light of Jesus to be eclipsed.
Right.
Ooh,
right.
On this world.
Here.
You know, how important
it
is.
Yeah. Well, you can almost imagine what they were going through as things were normal, and then suddenly the light starts going away and the fear aspect comes in. And maybe during that fear aspect, they inner-reflect and do their own form of praying and whatever. And then when the light starts coming back, they get to reflect that maybe prayer is a really useful thing. You know?
Or maybe it's a good idea to sacrifice all those cows.
Yeah. Or whatever. Yeah. Who knows how that translates. But,
yeah,
but
sure,
yeah.
That might have been the immediate solution. But who knows?
Poor things that were sacrificed needlessly when, you know, and the primitive people all believing that that's why the sun came back.
Uh-huh.
You know, right. I mean,
well, there you go.
Not,
there you go.
Right.
But,
you know, the Iranian characterizes us as an age of, right now, as an age of science and enlightenment. And I think it's important to remember what science does for us, right? Because it lets us know the material workings of the universe, and that we don't have, you know, and in knowing that, in knowing, you know, and think about some of the sciences that have really helped us, you know, the science of weather, the science of being able to predict what the weather is going to do, how that helps us to avoid catastrophes or, you know, even personal catastrophes, or the science of medicine, the science of physics, you know, there's they have led us into a place where, and I know they can be misleading too, but it is interesting that they characterize this age as an age of science and enlightenment. And you wonder what it is that science does for us.
That's one of the things about eclipses in ancient times, is that stimulated the study of astronomy.
That's true.
Trying to figure
That's
out
right.
and calculate
right.
the next one is when it's going to happen and how it's going to happen. I mean, that stimulated a lot of curiosity and scientific development. I mean, we were talking, I think, before about the Antikythera mechanism, if you're familiar with that. You know, and one of the things that did was predict eclipses. And it was just an amazing feat of engineering and scientific understanding went into that. You know,
what did you call that?
In mathematics.
The Antikythera mechanism.
Oh,
Antikythera, huh?
No.
First time I've heard of it. I knew they could do it.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah. You should look it up later. It's really amazing. Yeah, it's something they discovered in an old ship, sunken ship off the Greek islands years ago.
Oh, wow.
And it was a sort of lump of, looked like decaying metal or something, you know, and they brought it up with everything else they found on the ship and didn't pay much attention to it until sometime later when they started looking more closely and realized this is a complex mechanism, you know, made of bronze, I guess, that was, you know, it's pretty badly corroded from being under the water for all this time. But they've kind of reverse engineered it now. And, you know, created replicas, you know, based on what they understand about it. And it's just this amazing device. And I'm not sure they know how old it is, but it's really old. You know, it goes way back.
Wow.
B.C., significantly B.C. And has all these years and things that turn and different proportions. And, you know, it's like looking at the inside of a Swiss watch. It's just crazy. And you could enter in stuff on the front, and then it would give you a readout on the back or something like that, that it would, you know, predict phases of the moon and eclipses and all kinds of things. And if you think in that region, you know, they say that the Andites in that region were very skilled in metalwork, particularly that one group that ended up in Crete for a while. They mentioned that about them, that they were skilled in metalwork. And then you had the Adamsonites coming in at some point also, to upset everything in that region. And here they find this thing at the bottom of the I don't know if that would be the Mediterranean or one of the bays off one of the Greek islands. You know, there's so many islands around there. But they discover this old sunken ship from way, way back. And it's this thing. And they go, whoa. It's almost like sci-fi.
Wow.
You know, it's how did they make this so long? So it kind of opens a window onto kind of maybe how advanced those cultures were in those days.
Yeah.
And we kind of lost touch with that.
Yeah, more than pottery, you know.
Yeah, more than pottery.
Oh, man.
An engineer's device.
And who but mariners would want that more than anyone? I mean, they so relied on the stars and the sky and the celestial, you know, for guidance. So, yeah, it would make perfect sense that it would be a part of something on a mariner's checklist. But it also makes you think, and I've been thinking about this a lot lately, how much on this planet has been lost and regained and lost and regained.
Yes.
How many times that has happened to us, you know?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Oh, my gosh.
It's almost,
Well, think of Akhenaten. How much he understood and gained, you know?
He was
so far beyond his time. And it was all around the sun, too. I mean, using the sun as a metaphor for God. I mean, it's just such a shame. It's just such a shame that his work was lost. You know, there wasn't cultural continuity built off of this understanding of things. You know, the priesthood came and tried to destroy it all, as they always do. You know, seeing it as a threat rather than a revelation.
The book calls him the remarkable Akhenaten. Remarkable. And it called Moses the matchless Moses, right? I mean, it's interesting.
Yes.
They choose certain humans and they give them this descriptor that gives you a heads up. You're like, wow, Van the Steadfast, right? Oh, what's he about?
You know? Human heroes.
Yeah, human heroes. Mm-hmm. And Amadon, of course. I mean, the heroes we've not had. And what you said, Chuck, reminds me that what does the universe teach us about, you know, it's like Jesus telling fortune, the sun rises to salute you every day. This is it does, the richest and most powerful man on earth. You think about that. Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
If the sun stops rising, then I have something to worry about.
Yeah.
But until then, I should just trust, you know, that things are going to work out.
Interesting little bit of anthropomorphism in there. Yeah, the sun's saluting you. I like
the sun's
that.
The saluting you.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
It salutes every day. And he also said at another time, the rain falls on the just and the unjust. You know, so, you know, I mean,
everybody gets
these
wet.
These are things, everybody gets wet sometimes, you know,
like
hardship happens to everybody. And if you could call rain a hardship, I don't think a farmer would call it that unless there's too much of it. But,
all right, well, that can happen. But,
yeah.
Anyway.
But here we are with, friends, look. It's almost a half an hour in, and even just three of us can have a half-hour discussion. It doesn't take any time, any effort.
No problem.
No problem.
No problem.
We gotta work
around
this.
Yeah, right.
I always appreciate it, though, because I think it feeds into what we're about to discuss, which is Section 4 of Paper 9. Relation of the infinite spirit to the universe, and Section 4 is the absolute mind. And I wasn't here for the last discussion on the universal manipulator, but I wondered if there's anything you guys want to recap about that.
Let's see.
It was a good discussion.
Well, there was this interesting thing at the beginning of that where they say that gravity is one of the most real, in italics, one of the most real and eternally dependable things in the whole physical universe and universes. I don't know, that statement struck me because, you know, we tend to take gravity for granted. I don't know. You know, it just is.
It's another thing
we
like
drop
the sun,
something
right?
And it falls to the ground. What's that? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
It's another one of those things that without it, we'd all be floating in space if we would even be at all.
Something like that.
If, yeah. Right.
Yeah.
But the fact that they emphasize real, it's the most real in italics, and eternal and eternally dependable things. I don't know. That's kind of cool. And then they relate that to paradise, of course, the source and substance of physical gravity. So that was kind of cool to reflect on that.
Yeah.
And then, of course, then there's anti-gravity, which comes up in that section, possesses this what they describe as a unique and amazing power, anti-gravity. So to be able
and
to
that,
null
yeah.
gravity is quite a thing.
When I was in India, I had a chance to learn from devout Hindus about their faith. And their three main gods.
Oh, that's
Brahma,
right. You were in
Vishnu.
India recently, right?
Yeah, in December.
You were in India. Oh, wow.
And we,
yeah,
and
right.
we visited.
Yeah, India.
Somehow word got out that Paul is interested in religions. Not
all
just,
right.
you know, religion, but religions. And so they told me that this part of India is famous for temples. And there's beautiful temples.
And which part?
Hindu temples.
Which part was that?
Southern India.
Which part was that? Southern.
Southern India.
Does that include
and it's, you know, that
okay.
would include Kerala. And I think where I was, though, in Chennai is like that one of the temple capitals of India. And they, yeah, and they speak Tamil, which is I think it's the oldest language on earth. And it's interesting that they tell us in the book that the earliest remains of humanity can be found in northern India. So I think about that a lot when, you know, when it's shown out there that Africa is the cradle of civilization because if we believe the Urantia book, then northern India is where the earliest human remains can be found. And I wonder if they've ever excavated there or not. But the reason I mentioned Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva is because I said to them when they were explaining the three main gods to me, I said, well, that's the Trinity. And they all looked at me really strange, like, wow, that's right. That is Trinity. And they explained Brahma, Vishnu, you know, Brahma is the main god, the first source. Vishnu is the original child of the main god. And Shiva, interestingly, they call the god of destruction. But as I was reading, you know, catching up for today, I realized that the god of action is the god of change. They say that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, destruction, sometimes to people, change means destruction. And I thought of, you know, the angels telling us in their great angelic wisdom, sometimes the planting of a seed necessitates its death.
Yeah.
The death, so it can be reborn into new life. And I hear Jesus saying, the old things are passing away. Behold, all things are becoming new. And I think, okay, so the old things are passing away can look to us like destruction. But it's really just the morphing and the evolution of what has to be born, you know?
Right.
The old things sometimes have to leave so that the new things can come. And
the pain
of
childbirth.
Yeah. Yes. And for the child who is being pushed out of his environment. Right, being totally rejected by everything he knew. So that I can see how their Shiva would feel like the god of destruction. But yeah, interesting how much truth is in religions if we would just, you know, when we study them and really look for the conceptual similarities. It's wonderful what's revealed.
Oh, yeah, I love
look at them
that.
With that
yeah.
eye. Me too.
Mm-hmm.
Me too.
Well, there was another little place in the previous section that, I don't know, kind of relates to that a bit, where they're talking about the conjoint creator, the infinite spirit, as the manipulator of energy. So that implies change. And then they give this interesting little list, you know, or this list. But here, and this is in the fifth paragraph of that section, they say the conjoint creator is action. So, you know, we know that infinite spirit is the god of action. It makes things happen. And then there's the MDAS. So what they mean by action is motion, change, modification, coordination, stabilization, and equilibrium.
Mm-hmm.
So you think about those things as they relate to motion or even life in general, you know, how important all of those things are in terms of the energetic development of circumstances and how things change and flow and where the forces are coming from and all of that. Mm-hmm. I mean, here they're talking on a physical level, but, you know, we're on a foundation. All of our mindful and spiritual personal development is on a physical foundation. So we're impacted by these things.
I find it interesting that the way these terms are organized, just following the word action, it starts off with motion and then change and then modification and then coordination and then stabilization and equilibrium. So it starts off
right.
As
there's almost
chaos.
A sequence there.
Yes, there is.
Yep.
There's like, it's like chaos to order. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good point.
And you know what it occurred to me, Chuck, is you telling us that while you observed your baby grandson, or your 2-year-old, 3-year-old grandson, that he was just one big urge. You know, it's just
all
these
urges.
Yeah, and a bundle of urges, and that's what it is. It's an urge of life keeps urging us forward. That's the motion. We can't stop. We have to keep moving forward and allow evolution to have its way with us and life to have its way with us.
Yeah.
You know,
and those urges
the God of action.
come from the third source and center. Yeah, through the Mother Spirit.
Right.
I mean, the urges of the Ajna mind spirits. I mean, that's where that's how those urges are sort of delivered into the developing child, is through those mind spirits. And that's important because there wouldn't be any growth or development without those urges.
Absolutely.
But it's interesting to think of them in terms of what we just read, you know, that they think of a little 2-year-old running around, you know, creates motion and certainly change and they're modifying things and learning that they can maybe coordinate. If I do this, maybe that'll happen, you know.
Experimenting
all the time. Like, that's one of the things that sounds so fascinating about being a parent is when kids are little like that, they're all like little scientists.
Yeah.
Their minds are hungry to know.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, well, they experiment. They try stuff. They just see what happens, you know. And they learn from that.
And they learn. They learn from experience.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's amazing. And we're like that. We're like that on a different level. You stabilize and then you start again, I think. You stabilize at one level and then you start the process again, motion, change, modification, coordination, and then stabilization, equilibrium, and then you start again, you know, with each chapter in your existence.
Mm-hmm. Right. Each one is a foundation for the next kind of.
Right.
Yeah.
Which, of course, the Marantxa life is going to be exactly that. We'll start the process over again with a new mind, with 70 senses, with, you know, a new body. And we'll start the whole thing over again, just like babes in a new land. And how wonderful that'll be, only to be conscious that, okay, this is the second of this, you know, adventure, the second chapter in this grand adventure we call life.
Mm-hmm.
Endless life at that.
Well, then in the next paragraph, in the next paragraph, they carry that out to a universal scope, you know, and talk about the physical controllers and the power directors and all of that.
Right.
Which is almost mind-boggling to even think about how that's carried out. The maintenance of the, well, whether it's the getting to equilibrium when you're talking about huge astronomical forces and energies and bodies and space and all of that. I mean, we don't usually think of all this activity out there. You know, you look up at the stars at night or look at astrophotography and see, whoa, there's a lot going on out there. We don't usually think of that as being managed. You know what I mean? Of being held in a purposeful grasp by forces and beings that are responsible for the development of our universe.
Yeah. What are the scientists
noticing? It's all just random.
Yeah, but what are they noticing out there that really is the actual activity of the physical controller? You know, it's
you know, a lot they're noticing.
Yes, and but they don't know what, they don't have that concept of
they don't know what to make
controller.
Of it, do they?
No, no, that's what I'm saying. It's like, I wish I had an exact example for myself to understand, you know, maybe the black hole situation, you know, there's definitely got to be physical controllers involved in that concept. And
do you ever notice
how
that's
the concept that was invented to try to figure out what's going on?
Yeah,
you know, sort of like the Big Bang. You know, it's a human hypothesis.
True.
Well, did you ever notice that in these sections they tell us what they're classic, like university professors. They tell us what they're going to tell you, then they tell you what they tell you, and then they tell you what they told you. And this section is classic that way. And they end it with paragraph 8. Paradise is the pattern of infinity. The God of action is the activator of that pattern. Paradise is the material fulcrum of infinity. The agencies of the third source and center are the levers of intelligence, which motivate the material level and inject spontaneity into the mechanism of the physical creation. So they started out with paradise in the first, right, in the first paragraph, and then they tell us, you know, they end with paradise and what it is and what the God of action does.
Oh, good point. Good point.
Yeah.
To make that manifest.
Right before that is also pretty amazing, and it kind of supports what you're saying, I think. So the last sentence of the paragraph just before what you read.
7.
Says, last sentence of paragraph 7 says, the non-personal, impersonal, and otherwise not personal doings of the third source and center are all volitional acts of the conjoint actor himself. They are not reflections, derivations, or repercussions of anything or anybody.
Wow.
I don't know. It kind of cracks me up. But they're trying to make a point there. And then in the last paragraph that you read, Paula, then that becomes kind of like solidified in what they're saying.
Right. Yeah. He makes it work. He makes it happen.
There's the God of
it's like
I
Captain.
Yeah.
I'm off. There's
a good
man.
Here I come. Marching out.
I'm off to do your will.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're off to work today. What is it?
Hi ho.
Keep the universe going another day.
Which is a great segue, actually, to the absolute mind, because you know, it's what's behind the absolute mind.
Well, yeah.
Is what's behind. Yeah.
And the idea that all of this is volitional, you know, I think that's a really important concept that runs through the book, this idea of volitional occurrence, you know, that things happen for a reason. There's a purpose.
Right.
Done on purpose, right? Right. I mean, it's kind of wrapped up in the idea of these things being volitional.
Yeah. It's interesting to me that we would ever think otherwise.
Yeah.
We prefer to think of it as being a cosmic accident rather than to think of it as being purposeful, willful, an act of a divine mind.
Well, yeah, that creates, that creates a necessity to believe in a creator.
Right.
Yes, it does.
And it's easier to believe in the great cosmic accident than it is to believe in the great cosmic purpose and will.
That's right. Jumping the shark is not what scientists want to do because that gets out of their realm.
That's true.
It's out of their realm. And that's the beauty of revelation that we've been given, is that it helps us pull them together in their proper order.
And as we can see, what we think and what we believe has consequences, right? It all has consequences. And so I think we're innately worried about that. If I believe in a God, then there's consequences.
We have volition also. I mean, we are volitional actors also.
Right.
And
think how powerful that is.
Has a role to play.
Yeah.
In the unfolding.
So true, John.
But to
here
see
are all
the responsibilities.
These resources around us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Go ahead, sorry.
But no, I was just going to say that there's some responsibility wrapped up in the possession of volition.
Mm-hmm.
That it isn't just, oh, do what thou wilt. You know, it's like, there's a big project going on here, and I want to, do my part. Right? And that's a very different kind of motivation than just, unbridled self-assertion, let's say.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So there's a quality of motivation. Right. Maybe I should think about with the universe, because everything becomes more interesting when you see how what you're doing can possibly coordinate with what others are doing.
And
that coordination.
To the greater.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But that coordination
function
is very, very specifically related to the third source, and angelic ministry and all of that. It's all about coordinating, correlating.
That's part of the action principle we just read. Yeah.
Right.
Motion, change, modification,
exactly.
Coordination. Yeah.
Coordination. That's critical to the other, to the ones that come after, which are what? Stabilization and equilibrium.
Stabilization.
Right. Same is true. Socially and politically and governmentally and all kinds of ways.
Oh, yeah.
You need cooperation.
Well, innumerable.
This is a really good principle right here, isn't it?
Yeah. It really is.
Well,
anyway.
With that, shall we read section 4, The Absolute Mind?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Let's do it.
Who wants to read that? And I can, if one of you guys don't want to.
Yeah, please do.
Go ahead.
Go for it.
Paper 9, Relation of the Infinite Spirit to the Universe, Section 4, The Absolute Mind. There is an intellectual nature of the source and center that is distinct from his physical and spiritual attributes. Such a nature is hardly contactable, but it is associable. Intellectually, though not personally, it is distinguishable from the physical attributes and the spiritual character of the third person on mind levels of function. But to the discernment of personalities, this nature never functions independently of physical or spiritual manifestations. The absolute mind is the mind of the third person. It is inseparable from the personality of God the Spirit. Mind, in functioning beings, is not separated from energy or spirit, or both. Mind is not inherent in energy. Energy is receptive and responsive to mind. Mind can be superimposed upon energy, but consciousness is not inherent in the purely material level. Mind does not have to be added to pure spirit For spirit is innately conscious and identifying. Spirit is always intelligent, minded in some way. It may be this mind or that mind. It may be pre-mind or super-mind or even spirit-mind. But it does the equivalent of thinking and knowing. The insight of spirit transcends, supervenes, and theoretically antedates the consciousness of mind. The conjoint creator is absolute only in the domain of mind, in the realms of universal intelligence. The mind of the third source and center is infinite, utterly transcends the active and functioning mind circuits of the universe of universes. The mind endowment of the seven super universes is derived from the seven master spirits, the primary personalities of the conjoint creator. These master spirits distribute mind to the grand universe as the cosmic mind. And your local universe is pervaded by the Nebadon variant of the Orvantan type of cosmic mind. Infinite mind ignores time. Ultimate mind transcends time. Cosmic mind is conditioned by time, and so with space. The infinite mind is independent of space, but as descent is made from the infinite to the adjacent levels of mind, intellect must increasingly reckon with the factations of space. Cosmic force responds to mind even as cosmic mind responds to spirit. Spirit is divine purpose, and spirit mind is divine purpose in action. Energy is thing. Mind is meaning. Spirit is value. Even in time and space, mind establishes those relative relationships between energy and spirit, which are suggestive of mutual kinship in eternity. Mind transmutes the values of spirit into the meanings of intellect. Volition has power to bring the meanings of mind to fruit in both the material and spiritual domains. The paradise ascent involves a relative and differential growth in spirit, mind, and energy. The personality is the unifier of these components of experiential individuality.
Oh,
wow.
Yeah. Well, we got that. We got that.
Well, there's
out.
That. You know, do we?
What a section.
Wow. There's you could just take every single paragraph and unpack it for a long while. And I know probably things jumped out at you guys, but there was several that really jumped out to me. Anything off the bat?
Well, I noticed they brought up volition again in that last paragraph. Volition has power to bring the meanings of mind to fruit in both material and spiritual domains. That's a really interesting comment. I mean, just the way it's written.
And to bring them to fruit.
The idea of bring them to fruit. Yeah, that suggests it's a living process at the very least.
Mm-hmm.
But also that there's a sort of a culminating manifestation that's being worked out. You know, you think of how a fruit happens on a tree. You know, it starts with a flower, right? Well, it starts with a tree, but it starts with a seed. But the flower then becomes the fruit. And that's just such a, I don't know, cool metaphor maybe, or process. And then the fruit, then if it's good fruit, then we get nourishment from it. So this whole thing of, I don't know, what they're talking about here, bringing the meanings of mind to fruit in both the material and spiritual domains. It's interesting to consider.
Well, and you can just take off on that, too. I mean, this idea of fruit is always intriguing to me. Fruit is, you know, Jesus, well, we know the fruits of the Spirit, right? So, in other words, the fruition, it's the same, probably same root word, to bring to fruition what the Spirit longs for, to bring that Spirit value into reality, to make it happen, you know, is an act of volition. You can't do it otherwise. I choose to be kind. I choose to be loving. I choose to be patient. I choose to be sincere. I choose to be honest. I choose to be loyal. We make those choices. Those choices are real. Mm-hmm. And they bring forth fruit. You know, this and the fruit is real. The fruit is real. It, you may not be able to quantify it, but it's real nonetheless.
It's the character of God. Fruit is the character of God. Yeah.
Right. And we're making it real by choosing to manifest it. Right.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, well,
through an act of our own volition.
Consuming it.
Well, and when it comes forth, it's a blessing to everybody, right? It blesses everybody.
Mm-hmm.
What value is a tree that never blossoms and bears fruit? It blesses nobody. Well, maybe if you want to hang out in the shade, it
shade
might serve that one purpose.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. But,
as you find the climb.
Yeah. But
that last
bears
that
nothing,
last paragraph, though. Yeah. No,
go ahead, Chuck.
Oh, well,
no,
I was going to say that last paragraph. Yeah, go for it.
we're at odds here, pal. No, you go. I insist. The last paragraph.
I was just going to point out that last paragraph is about us. You know, the second sentence, and, you know, following the first part, they then say, the paradise is sent, pretty clearly addressing us, I think. The paradise ascent involves a relative and differential growth in spirit, mind, and energy. The personality is the unifier of these components of experiential individuality. So I was just going to point out that I think there's a correlation there between volition and personality. That the personality provides the volition that enables all this stuff to happen. Anyway.
Well, there is, where is that paragraph where they talk about the triad? You know what I'm talking about? Which paragraph?
Oh,
it's funny.
Here it is.
This is five. Cosmic force responds to mind, even as cosmic mind responds to spirit. That in itself is like, wow. That statement, cosmic force responds to mind, even as cosmic mind responds to spirit. Spirit is divine purpose, and spirit mind is divine purpose in action. Energy is thing, mind is meaning, spirit is value. They're just taking a triad apart here now. They're telling us energy, mind, and spirit. Thing, meaning, and value. So they give us a, you know, I love to line those triads up with the three original sources and centers, right? Because it helps me understand them better.
Right.
Energy is thing, mind is meaning. When we think about something, we're trying to understand the meaning of it. When we think of it spiritually, when we spiritualize it, we're trying to understand its value. Energy is things. Science is the study of things, right? Mind is philosophy. It's the study of meaning. What does it all mean? But spirit is value. It's what brings value to our lives. Even in time and space, mind establishes those relative relationships between energy and spirit which are suggestive of mutual kinship in eternity.
Well, you know, this very thing, this energy is thing, mind is meaning, spirit is value, is the heart Ian McGilchrist is getting at in his book, The Matter with Things, is that there has been so much concentration over the past 200-300 years toward materialism, toward energy, towards things. And his goal is to try to move us back into the mind arena and the value and arena of spirit. And he breaks this down into such an incredible psychological and just on so many levels as the polymath. He'll use poetry. He'll use all kinds of imagery to state this and show ways that we can move out of the limiting view of energy and life as thing, which is very left hemispherical and very cut off from the mind spirit value of the right hemisphere. So I have to bring that up because that is the essence of what he's trying to share with us, and it's so timely because of the limitations that science has, like we were talking about earlier, jumping the shark, you know. You know, science has to be, scientists have to be willing to entertain, you know, the larger picture. So, yeah, I love this breakdown, and I'm glad you brought that out.
Yeah, no, I do too. Well, you know, the other thing this does, and along with what you're saying, Pam, is it really articulates or shows the flow of reality, how the flow of reality into manifestation works. It's like in the first part there, cosmic force responds to mind, even as cosmic mind responds to spirit. So that's very clearly suggesting that it starts on the spirit level, and then the mind responds to spirit, and then once the mind's got a grasp on it, then the cosmic forces can respond to mind. So that flow of reality from spirit to mind, the physical manifestation, is so critical to understand, because otherwise you're gonna have a valueless world. You're going to have a valueless life. I mean, if you try and work it from the other end, you know, which is what science has been trying to do. Yeah.
Yes, and that's one of the biggest discussions in psychological, philosophical science these days is, what is consciousness? And what is mind? And, there's the debate. Some are saying consciousness is matter. Well, maybe it is if you think of matter originally being spirit. So, you know, in other words, you know, matter is spirit slowed down.
Well,
right?
Matter has a spirit purpose. Yeah, it has a spirit purpose.
Yeah. So anyway, this is such a major discussion. That's out there in the field, and it's been fun to try to monitor, you know, who comes as close to the Urantia viewpoint. That's my challenge, is to, you know, and I must say McGilchrist is pretty darn close.
That's great.
I definitely want to get that book. It's quite expensive, but I really wanted it. I've looked at it. It must be out of print. Is it out of print?
Well,
Pam?
No, he keeps republishing it because it is selling.
Oh, does he? Okay, good. Well, I'm going to get me one. You've intrigued me so much with that.
I got one that was a discounted. So I shopped. Mm. You know, I think
yeah,
I,
you shopped. Okay.
I spent 60 or 80 instead of 170.
Wow. Okay.
So,
yep, that's about
what
I
mean?
saw.
It's all relative. Yeah.
Yeah. But I think it's good because we're clearly in an age of materialism, which is perhaps what science brings about, right? What an understanding of science brings about. It's like, you know, all of a sudden we're learning how to master material. And, I want me some of that, you know?
Right. Well, exactly.
And maybe that's, I think humans tend to move in well-defined stages, just like children do. And I think as we evolve, we go through these stages. And they, in fact, say that we're in a stage of materialism, you know, material-mindedness, where, you know, we're thinking about material things a lot.
To our detriment. You know?
Right.
Yeah.
Which calls for us to be more balanced and make an effort to achieve more balance in our lives than to just be focused on material things all the time.
Well, the cultural,
you know?
Our cultural grasp of the nature of spirit is very weak, I think.
Very weak.
We have some understanding of mind. I mean, we have a lot of understanding of stuff, you know, material stuff. Round, that's hard. We observe the physical qualities of the material level, and then we think, you know, we're aware of the fact that we do some thinking sometimes, some sense of what the mind is about. But spirit, that's kind of a mystery. I mean, even the concept of consciousness doesn't necessarily imply spirit. You know, it's kind of more like oftentimes it just sort of gets trapped in the realm of awareness. It doesn't encompass will and purpose and all these other things. So, I mean, consciousness is a profound mystery, of course. So it's endlessly fascinating and intriguing how that could even be happening at all in our little arena, you know, as it's gifted.
Right.
Well, not so little. But spirit, I mean, I just have to say, when I first started reading the Aransi book, that was the major revelation for me, you know, in the beginning. And I was so happy to have this sorted out, that reality is organized into, like, it's this triad here, you know, matter, mind, and spirit. Each one is a realm of reality. It's an experienceable realm, and they all interact, and they have their, you know, they engage in their various ways, and it's so important to understand that, because I had no concept of spirit. I mean, what's spirit? You know, is that ghosts or what? You know, or people get all kinds of strange places.
You can't hold it in your hand like a thing.
But the idea that spirit is where values are found. That to me was the key revelation, and that's in a different realm from meaning. You know, the values and meaning have different functions. And they each have their own realm. I mean, just sort of getting that straightened out was so helpful.
Without a doubt.
About spirit, but that particular, the value aspect, it's like, oh, that's why spirituality is important. It's because that's where we get our values.
It's value reality.
I don't know.
Spirituality is value reality. And value consciousness. And interestingly, mind, as if you look at mind as philosophy, then that's the bridge between the matter and spirit. Philosophy bridges you over. Philosophy is what gets you there. You have to develop a philosophy of, you know, life, where you understand the meaning of
relationships.
You know,
relationships.
And relationships and lessons and experiences and teachings and whatever else you know is offered to you. You have to understand the meaning of that. What's the meaning? And if you can get a meaning out of it, then you can find the value of it, right? Then you get to the value.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I often Well, go ahead, Chuck. Go ahead.
No, you go. Your turn.
Well, I was going to say I often have told people that, you know, one of the things that Anthony Robbins often says is modern men and women need to ask a better question, need to learn to ask a better question. And I remember pondering that and saying, okay, so what would be a better question? And the thing that came to my mind immediately or that comes to my mind immediately is when something bad happens, a lot of times people ask this question. They ask, why is this happening to me?
Mm-hmm.
Why does this stuff always happen to me? You know?
Mm.
Whereas a better question would be, what am I learning from this? And that's getting to the meaning of the experience so that you can find then the value of it.
Yes.
What am I learning from this experience is, what value does this experience have to me? Even though it appears to be a bad experience or a sad experience or a painful experience or whatever, what value is there for me as an important being, as a human, as a child of God, as someone who plans to live forever? What relevance does this experience have for me, and what am I learning from it? And that is, and that would be, you know, for me, that was the example of a better question. And the question gets at the meaning, and then the meanings get at the value.
Yeah,
you have to go in that process.
Yeah, you have to step aside from the confusion. NLP has a similar type of phrase, when you just stop and say, what else could this mean? Which is good, because you've got the word meaning in there. What else could this mean? You know, so it forces you to rethink it, to get mental about meaning.
To contemplate, as Jesus said, to contemplate.
What
does that mean to you? And, you know, it's like you said, you know, the spiritual realities have a little chance of making an impact on anybody who spends little or no time contemplating them. Right. So you have to contemplate them.
What happens when you explore the meaning of something like that, inevitably that's an evaluation process. Because let's say there's your immediate sort of like, why does it always happen to me, or whatever. But then you think about, well, let me think about this a little bit more. Maybe there's more to be understood here. And then as you have maybe a menu of possibilities about what it might mean, then you have to evaluate those meanings in order to come to some kind of decision about how to coordinate that within your life and drive.
Right.
You know, so the evaluation process is where spirit kind of sneaks into all of this stuff, I think.
Yeah,
and don't you love that value is in that word? Evaluate.
I know, that's what I'm saying. Exactly.
Yeah, you are gleaning the value.
Right. And that's inevitable in life. We're constantly making evaluations, but without really realizing that that's kind of how we touch spirit, or how spirit touches us, is through our evaluations. And the penetration of meaning inherently kind of brings that into play. So they become, associated.
The meaning is the bridge.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just want to point out this sort of speaks to that, maybe this last sentence in the fifth paragraph, where they say that even in time and space, mind establishes those relative relationships between energy and spirit, which are suggestive of mutual kinship in eternity.
Yes.
And that's one of those kind of statements
that's a beauty.
Where you think you know what they're about to say. Okay. But then they throw in the cosmic significance of that.
That is so beautiful.
It's very irascible kind of comment.
It is very
without a doubt.
I know the word relative is in there, and the word relationship is in there, and it's spirit and energy and spirit. This whole idea of mind, of matter, mind and spirit. You know, I think basic. You know, we've heard mind over matter, right? We've heard that term before, mind over matter. Well, and then it's spirit over mind, because mind is the halfway point. It's the negotiator between the material and the spiritual. So, And so mind is the mind arena of choice. And
right.
There's volition again, you know.
And that's where that happens.
So in fact, you know, in whatever conversations I might be on in the outside world, I like to, if there's an opportunity, to bring up the fact that, yes, mind over matter, but spirit over mind. You know, it's like, it's a trinity, it's a triunity of relationships, relative relationships between energy and spirit. You know, energy being the matter and spirit,
And
you know, this is so juicy. Stuff is so
about
juicy.
That is that we, you know, we tend to think of energy and spirit as being the most divergent realities that we experience. You know, how could the pavement on my driveway have anything to do with the spiritual choices I'm making or whatever? I don't know, it's kind of a crude example.
Yeah.
But we tend to think of matter and spirit as being divergent realms that are completely unrelated, even possibly. Or even, you know, in opposition to each other or something. But here they're pointing out that, well, they actually have this kinship relationship in eternity.
Yes.
Energy and spirit are kin to each other.
Interrelated, yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well,
they come from the same source.
It's interesting what you just said, Chuck, brought up to mind for me the lyrics from a Beatles song that was really crucial to me at a difficult time in my life. It was right after my first husband, Bob, was killed in a car accident. And the Beatles, literally, I mean, I listened to the Beatles nonstop after that. For whatever reason, their music was very healing to me. And there's a song, you know, one of their lesser maybe popular songs. I don't really know how popular it is. I think all of their music is popular because it's all good and meaningful. But they say, I'm fixed in a hole where the rain gets in.
Oh,
it keeps my mind from wandering where it will go. And, I'm changing the room in a number of ways or in a colorful way. And when my mind is wandering, there it will go. And I think how often, you know, what that song means to me is, like you say, what does fixing the driveway have to do with it? But it's interesting.
Yeah,
if you let something material that needs to be done hang over you and you endlessly procrastinate about fixing that, it will stop your mind from wandering where it will go. And when it goes where it will go, wow, that is a wonderful place. Where it will go, if you allow it to go with no encumbrances of things that need to get done and little chores, and they niggle you and they nag at you and whatever, and you keep putting them off and keep putting them off. But you can't have the peace of mind then that you need to let your mind wander where it will go. And, you know, and actually do things in your life to help your mind go where it will go. And so, interestingly, when we learn to master the material realm, we actually are providing a conducive place for our garden, our mental garden, to grow.
Yeah, right.
And
well, you think of what you were just saying about letting your mind go where it will go. I mean, that's responding to the adjutant urges.
Yeah.
Yes.
We somehow cultivate our ability to do that, to respond to these urges that have been gifted by the Mother Spirit to stimulate our growth and understanding and our curiosity, especially. You know, so wondering where your mind will go. I mean, that's talking about curiosity pretty directly.
Right.
And one of the adjutants is directly related to. You could almost call it the adjutant of curiosity. I don't know. I think knowledge, maybe, or something.
Yeah, which
it's
is
the scientific
urge
that makes you want to figure out how stuff works and makes you want to explore and go places you haven't been before. All of those motivations take root or come out of that adjutant. And that's why
you know
wandering
something,
where
you fall
where
in love
will
with
go. Yeah, yeah. That's great insight about that about that song, Paula. I never thought of it that way, but that makes a lot of sense.
No, I hadn't.
I remember that.
I hadn't thought
it spoke to my heart.
I hadn't thought about that at all.
I've always liked that song.
A whole different meaning in there for me, but that's beautiful.
Right.
The thing is, too, is that what you're talking about is really important in an energy-based culture. You know, we are kind of stuck on the material plane, and it's very important that we allow ourselves to wander and wonder. And actually, the whole idea, though, for me is almost the opposite, because I am very easily wandering to another concept or to another place to dwell, and it's like, I need to come back more to a modification or a coordination and a stabilization and an equilibrium, because I tend to go off in too many directions.
Yeah.
Mm.
So,
well, that's almost like a meta wondering. You wonder, well, what would happen if I just focused on this for a minute?
Well, I know, and I think it's the curiosity thing, because it's like food. It's all food out there, you know. But it's like, okay, you know. And then I have to be careful not to be a glutton. Okay.
A mental glutton.
Yeah.
Yes, a mental glutton.
Yeah.
So, anyway, here
we are. We're speaking of this gift of mind, which the conjoint creator gives us. This gift of mind. And, you know, how we might, and I think this is such an important discussion, because how do we use that gift or abuse that gift or neglect that gift, right? And, you know, there's a lot of talk about mental health these days. And the Arantia book calls certain things mental poison, right? Suspicion, doubt, anger, you know, they're mental poisons. And, you know, so there is something important about this gift of mind that we can utilize for our benefit through our volition, as you point out, Chuck, to choose to clear out the noise, to choose to let, you know, peace and calm come in. It's like water in a way. I see water and I see it being either turbulent, like in a storm, you know, with waves crashing and just whipping about and this and that, or calmness where, you know, after the storm, calmness comes back and now all of a sudden things make more sense. It's not so chaotic. Mind is like that for me, you know, and if something disturbs our mental state, we feel it. If we're more in touch with our own mental state and our own inner being, then when something disturbs that mental state, we really feel it. We're aware of it. And we can actually, you know, say, what was it that disturbed that for me? What did that to me? And actually pinpoint what it was, you know, and learn maybe how to recognize and identify those, we call them triggers, before they happen, or even maybe diffuse them after they happen by understanding, that was just an agitation in my mental state and I don't need to let it stand. I don't need to let it keep agitating me. You know, interesting now, this talk of mind, what we understand about it and what we don't understand about it, right?
Right.
Well, I think there's a really interesting sort of, I don't know if you call it a message or not, but running through this, it's sort of not really stated, but it certainly is clear in other parts of the book in some ways about how this volitional capacity that we have by virtue of the fact that we have mind, sometimes that's reactive. In other words, our mind engages and we have to react to a situation.
Mm-hmm.
And we can become better and wiser at doing that, you know, how we handle anger and other things. You know, we can grow in our reactive qualities of mind. But then beyond that, there's also the initiation potential of mind where, okay, I'm done reacting to things today. Now I'm going to actually do something from my own volition, right? I've got this idea that I want to bring to fruition, right, as they talk about. And I'm going to, that's something to do as opposed to something to react to. You see what I mean?
Right.
There's a kind of a difference.
Yes.
There's a big difference there. And I think the, you know, they talk about the psychic circle. But I think reaching the third circle has a lot to do with moving more and more into that other approach to life where you're initiating rather than reacting.
There you go.
And,
ooh, responding,
that's,
in other words. That's another way of saying it. You're responding rather than reacting. You know.
Even responding is kind of reacting because you're acting
that's
based
true.
On something that happened outside of yourself.
But,
whereas
initiation
is something that comes more from the spirit within.
However, the word
in other words, you don't have to respond.
Well, I mean, there's
nothing wrong with respond. Yeah.
The word respond is the heart of the word responsibility. Okay, so that's the positive aspect of responding. Yeah. That's all.
Well, yeah.
You know,
and responsibility can lead to initiative too.
Yes.
If you're in a position where you're responsible for the unfolding of events in some arena, even if it's just your own life,
right?
If you realize that you can have command over that and make decisions that initiate something new and different and manifest a reality that hasn't been seen before, you know, that's what's fun about being an artist of any kind, music or anything, because you're creating things that wouldn't exist if you didn't create it. So, you initiate the creation of this thing, whether it's a piece of music or a piece of art or photograph or whatever, that can go out into the world and have an influence that wouldn't be there if you hadn't done that.
It's sort of godlike, isn't it?
Yeah, well, kind of, in a funny way. Yeah, or child of God.
In a funny way. Kind of godlike.
the initial
impetus.
Yeah. So the other interesting thing about this, when they talk about reaching the third circle, that's when your adjuster becomes self-acting.
Yeah.
So to think about the human reaching that level, the human is becoming not just reacting to every little thing that happens to me. Yeah, you know, I have a way of sort of, okay, I'm gonna initiate for a minute here instead of just react. That's a becoming self-acting on a human level. So it's interesting how that correlates with this idea of our gesture becoming self-acting. And I've always felt that there's kind of on a parallel track with our adjuster. That our adjuster development kind of depends on our development, and our development depends on our adjuster development. There's kind of a handshake going on there or something. I don't know even how to describe it. But there's a pattern of development that seems to run in parallel.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So
that's,
like when they talk about the adjuster.
True.
The adjuster becoming a thought controller, it can only do that if we are able to control our thoughts. It can't be a thought controller if we can't control our thoughts. How is the adjuster going to control them, right? So
and even just contemplate our own thoughts. You know, I mean, when we have a thought and the thought is just like maybe brutally harsh or negative, right? To say, well, wait a minute. And this is what I find myself doing a lot lately, you know, as I get older, okay, as I get, say, in the last, oh, God, I don't know, decade or so, saying to myself, wait a minute, what does that serve? How would that do any good? What would that create? You know, and to ask myself a series of questions about the thought I just had, like, especially if it's negative about a personality, I think, what value would that bring? Or if I feel like I should say something snarky, what purpose would that serve? You know?
Yes, as much as you might want to, yes.
As much as
I might want to,
I am immediately arrested in my thought about, wait a minute. What good is that going to do? None.
Yeah, right.
That will not help the situation, not one iota. So, and I immediately, it immediately shifts my consciousness to another place to say, forget about that. Think of something more constructive and positive to do. And that's actually, you know, how they say you recognize growth in retrospect, that's something that's very joyful for me. I think, wow, that was a wonderful, that's a wonderful one, to not just respond thoughtlessly or react, maybe is what the getting back to reactions and responses.
Yeah, react might be more,
Yeah, not just react, but actually think about.
Be reactive. Yeah, reactive.
Right.
You know, there's all the people getting triggered all the time. You know, they're all so reactive. You know,
right.
Count to 10.
Right.
Maybe think of something better.
Everybody reacting. Yeah.
So,
whereas
yeah,
you
yeah.
just
so
breathe.
Self-acting. Yeah.
Put some space. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
right.
wow.
reactive to self-acting. Yeah.
Wow.
Good.
Yeah, right. That's kind of it. You know, I think that's a major step in our development. You know, self mastery wise. You know, thinking about self mastery.
Yeah.
As
understanding
to
mind
psychic,
and the
psychic circle. Yeah, development.
And I just want to say, Pam, I love your statement about responsibility, because that occurred to me once long ago that, you know, oftentimes we use that as a negative word. I'm gonna that's your responsibility. You know, and like, wow, I don't want to hear that.
You're being irresponsible.
Oh, yeah, you're being irresponsible. Right.
Ooh.
Whereas when you look at responsibility, and the root word is, the word itself says your ability to respond. It's like to say, well, you have the ability to respond to that. Maybe you alone have the ability to respond to that.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe someone else also has the ability to respond to that, but you for sure have the ability to respond. It's not a bad thing. It's not a bad thing to take that ability onto yourself and say, okay, I do have the ability to respond. How shall I do that? And be more deliberate about it, right? And not
especially when you're responding maybe to an inner leading,
Right, exactly.
You know, that's also a realm of response, because the adjuster is always trying to, you know, urge us, you might say. There's the urge of the adjuster that kind of crowns the urges of the attuned spirits.
Yes.
And the adjuster's urge is to point us Godward and to think
spirit
beyond.
Over time.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, picturizations of destiny, that kind of thing.
There you go.
And to respond to those kinds of leadings, that's like super important. But to really do that, we have to take a lot of initiative, because we're talking about something original, something's not been done before. You know, the cultivation of originality. You know, Jesus would talk about that. He would talk about originality and initiative tend to go together, and Jesus mentioned that at least a couple of times.
Say that again.
That's what he was interested in, was cultivating this combination of originality and initiative.
Oh, originality,
in his his followers. You know, they weren't just like going to follow some religion where they just repeat things they've been told and sit somewhere and pretend like that's religion.
Right.
You know, you know, like in the two
sing-songy slaves to tradition. Right.
You know, the religion of the mind versus the religion of the spirit.
And
the problem of
to be a bond servant to a slave to tradition is to be a slave to something meaningless. I mean, if a ritual has
something outside
you,
yourself,
wonderful, right. Right, but if it has no meaning, you're just doing it because you think somebody wants you to do it, someone expects it, you know, and this is what I do, and I do it in a perfunctory way, and I don't necessarily find any meaning in it. But if it is meaningful, then do it, you know, because now it's bringing some kind of value to you. If you can find meaning in it, then you can find value in it. But if you can't find any meaning or value in it, don't do it. What's the point?
Yeah.
Right?
Or,
you're just
or
doing it because perhaps you think that's what God wants you to do, but then you have to say, but why? Why would God want me to, you know,
perhaps the
do
level
this?
Of your, the level of your meaning may not be as serviceable to you as what else could this mean? In other words, for somebody stuck in an institutional, you know, it's like it is sort of reactive. It's just sort of it's flat, you know. Doesn't Jesus even say this in the Bible that, you know, you are neither warm nor hot, so I spew thee from my mouth, you know.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
I think that's what that's all about, is that you are too lukewarm. That's the word he uses, lukewarm. So that's what I hear you saying, is that you have to reach beyond a placid kind of acceptance.
Yeah. It's hard to feel enthusiastic about conformity.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Oh, you rebel, you.
Well, I completely get
so
that. I mean, and if it is hard to feel.
Yeah.
Well,
it should be, right?
No, we're
if
not
it's
talking
hard to be enthusiastic.
We're just talking about modification, coordination, stabilization, and equilibrium.
Right. In that order.
In that
order. Where does that fit in?
You know?
Yeah, that's my new mantra, I think. It keeps coming up.
There you go. That's a good one, too. I like that. Well, in that vein, I want to skip to paragraph 4, if I could. Or let's see, is it? No, it's 2. It's paragraph 2, where they say this. And it's so intriguing to me. Mind does not have to be added to pure spirit. For spirit is innately conscious and identifying. Spirit is always intelligent, minded in some way. It may be this mind or that mind. It may be pre-mind or super-mind, even spirit mind. But it does the equivalent of thinking and knowing. The insight of spirit transcends, supervenes, and theoretically antedates the consciousness of mind. Wow.
Yeah.
So spirit.
Yeah.
Those mind spirits, they're here for us through the local universe, right? Correct me if I'm wrong. We're plugged into those adjutant mind spirits. And one of the things that came out at the retreat we did was those mind spirits are our mind. They represent the sum and substance of our mind. All 7 of them makes us a human, a minded human, a will dignity, right? Those 7 adjutants, all functioning, are our mind. Okay.
It's like our operating system.
It's our operating system. But once we become full-fledged spirits, if I'm understanding this correctly, it doesn't have to be added. For spirit is innately conscious and identifying. Spirit is always intelligent, minded in some way. Wow. It supersedes. Mm-hmm. And then it says that the inside of spirit transcends, supervenes, and theoretically antedates the consciousness of mind.
Yeah.
So when we're seeking... Go ahead, Pam.
No. While we're seeking, go on.
Well, when we're seeking insight, spirit insight, we're actually supervening and transcending and antedating the consciousness of our own mind. When we're thinking with our spirit, that is our superconsciousness. That's why they call it superconsciousness, right? I mean, that is such an important statement that they make right there. Mind transcends.
Is innately conscious and identifying. What do you think they mean by that?
Identifying, yeah.
Yeah.
Innately conscious and identifying. You know, and even then it goes back to the fragment, the pure fragment of Father Spirit that is within us gives us identity.
Mm-hmm.
So that
true
speaks
enough,
to
yeah.
that.
Mm-hmm.
It does, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Identifying.
Okay.
It's identifying with the pure, perhaps the purest essence there is, which is spirit. Well, they tell us that in so many ways. Spirit is reality. It's the greatest reality. Material is just the shadow of that real substance of spirit. So mind must also be the same thing in itself and of itself. the I am, a fragment of that identity. It's identifying. It's conscious and identifying. It's always intelligent, minded in some way. You know?
Yeah.
That's,
you know,
just
what
such an intriguing statement.
You know,
that's why it,
this reminds me of, oh, go ahead.
Well, go ahead.
Oh, well, I was just going to say, this reminds me of what they say about how, you know, relating to the psychic circles, I think when we reach the first circle, we can graduate to Maranja mind to some extent. Or they say that even during this lifetime, if you reach the first circle, you will receive a, I forget the word they use, like a superimposition of Maranja mind onto adjutant mind. And Maranja mind, of course, is closer to spirit, right? So
right.
It's a preview or an anticipation of what, you know, in the next life, when we have a full-on Maranja form with Maranja mind, we can begin to that possibility even during this life, if, you know, once having reached the first circle. But that idea of Maranja mind being the next sort of stage of our spiritual development beyond, because adjutant mind is designed to function in a physical organism. So as we make that transition, we transfer our seat of identity, as they say, from our physical vehicle to our soul, you know, our soul vehicle, our soul identity, is our soul identity emerges and evolves even during this lifetime, that can receive this higher kind of mind, Maranja mind. And that's to me, that's a very exciting possibility. I don't know what it takes to reach the first circle. It's probably not easy, but, but it provides some incentive. But it goes along with what you're saying about spirit having minded qualities, or how do they, having qualities of mind that are associated directly with spirit. And we get a little more of that maybe as we approach the Maranja level.
Well, in that last sentence, the insight of spirit transcends, supervenes, and antidotes the consciousness of mind. So, I mean, it gets back, for me, it gets back to spirit over mind over matter, and that the mind works with spirit and upon matter. That's
what do you
kind
think
of
they
way.
Mean? What do you think they mean there,
I
though, by
it.
Antedating? That what do you mean by that?
Precedes.
Antedating.
Precedes. Precedes.
Came before. It kind of came before.
And theoretically, they say theoretically. It comes before.
Yeah, there's a qualifier.
theoretically.
That's just such an intriguing statement.
So it's like, spirit, once again, spirit is the main ingredient of which everything is created from, including mind.
It all flows.
Right, including reality
flows.
In other words,
it supersedes mind.
Right.
And yet mind is needed to come into a material universe, mind is necessary to bridge the gap between
that's
spirit
how we
get
started.
And matter.
That's how we get started.
Yeah.
That's our introduction.
So that's why
reality.
So that's why it answers.
In a physical form, which is just amazing if you think about it.
Yeah.
You know, what the life carriers have done. I mean, the human, if you want to call it technology, the technology of the human organism. Receptivity capacity for spirit.
Yeah.
It's just like mind-blowing.
Well, I want to see where in the brain, or on the brain does the adjuster reside, dwell, hover?
Well, the adjuster dwells in the mind, not the brain. They make that pretty clear.
Right.
But we need the brain to receive mind. Yeah.
So are we saying that the adjuster is not affecting the right hemisphere? Is it above the body? Is it in our aura? What do you think?
It's in our intellect.
If I can find it.
I think it's within our body. It hovers.
mm-hmm. It hovers.
Okay. Here, this might give us a clue. They say here in paper 65, the physical brain with its associated nervous system possesses innate capacity for response to mind ministry.
Mm.
Okay. So that's, I'm going to read the rest of the sentence in a second, but that's kind of like, even like with a smartphone, you know, it has a circuitry to respond
mm-hmm.
to the cloud or whatever,
mm-hmm.
you know, we have this capacity.
Right.
So
right.
The physical, so you think of our physical brain and
it
our associated
in.
Nervous system is like a big antenna kind of, you know,
mm-hmm.
sort of. So the physical brain and its associated nervous system possesses innate capacity for response to mind ministry, just
nice.
As the developing mind of a personality possesses a certain innate capacity for spirit receptivity,
uh-huh.
and therefore contains the potentials of spiritual progress and attainment.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like a three-layer sandwich, kind of.
That's
yeah,
what
you know,
I
right. brain
I see three,
receives
I see three bubbles.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know what's interesting?
We're at the core.
What
our mental,
what
our,
I hear
our,
in this,
our physical being is at the core. Go ahead, Pam.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And what I hear in this is this is the way McGilchrist tries to imagine how it all works. Is that the mind, the brain, permits consciousness. It allows for consciousness. It doesn't make it, but it permits is the word he uses. And so what you just read, Chuck, almost says that to me. It's an intervener, you know. In
yeah.
other words, consciousness is not inherent in matter, and it is, but the matter of the brain permits consciousness to do its thing.
Well, it has reception.
Yeah, right.
He uses
the word permits, allows, which I think is a really delicate way of let's just say, traveling in this difficult arena, you know. Anyway, it's just part of the conversations that are going out there in the scientific world.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. That's interesting. Yeah,
it
no,
is
it's
interesting.
A good puzzle,
and,
for sure.
Bob on the board says, it is possible that the pineal gland is the location of our spirit, located at the bottom center of our brain.
Oh, that's interesting.
Brain.
Yeah.
Yeah. That, I think the gland system has a lot to do with that. But it's interesting to me that we're both, we're receivers, but we're also transmitters, right? And we
mm-hmm.
transmit our thoughts. We put our thoughts
yeah.
out there. And maybe the Father intercepts those and sends them back to us, then
uh-huh.
adjusts them and then sends them back. You know,
mm.
it's interesting.
Well,
if he is outside
maybe, yeah,
the in the
yeah.
outer bubble, you know.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the interesting thing about the endocrine system is that it has these seven primary locations in our body.
Right.
Right.
You know,
right.
And that, which very much appear to correlate to the seven adjutants.
Right.
So the thing about the,
I agree.
The
I
pineal
agree.
And the other, what's the other one that's right next to it? Anyway, these ones that seem to have some role in spiritual reception capacity, that may be related to the spirit of wisdom and the spirit of worship, that those adjutants make contact are received physically by these endocrine centers in our body, and the higher ones receive the higher adjutants. I mean, I don't know. I wonder if animals have, they probably have different capacities in this regard. But to get the full functioning mind that includes the spirit of worship and the spirit of wisdom, that requires, you know, this full functioning of this our endocrine system, apparently. And the has locations in our body, which is kind of what's crazy about it. But it makes a lot of sense. And we talked about this before,
yeah.
you know, like the third, you know, the gut, be like
right.
the spirit of courage. You know, people talk about having guts, you know, and that's like located, you know, in that part of our body. This, and then, of course, there's chakra correlations with all of this as well. Or, the you know, the spirit of wisdom is like looking down from above. You know, it makes sense that that would be at the top.
Right, right.
Just funny correlations like that. But you think about the design of our bodies and how incredibly complex and marvelous it is to be able to receive mind, first of all.
That's right.
You know,
as above, so below.
And then
we are
functioning of the mind spirits allows the reception of the adjuster and the spirit influences. Well, starting with the Holy Spirit. You know, the Holy Spirit can't function until all seven agents are sort of kicked in, right? And then the Holy Spirit prepares our mind for the reception of the adjuster. So there's a developmental progression that, you know, enables these higher and higher levels of receptivity.
Volition,
but,
choice, action.
Well, based
on the
will down to our last...
through all of this. Oh, that went by fast.
There it is. Yeah, I know.
There it
is. What a great conversation. We're down to our last 4 minutes.
Other things we were going to say.
You know, we didn't even scratch the surface.
I want
to, in light of all of the things we've been discussing, this quote, this particular quote comes to mind. I'd like to close us off with that and any final thoughts.
All right.
This is from paper 111-115, and you guys know it well. Mortal mind is a temporary intellect system loaned to human beings for use during a material lifetime. And as they use this mind, they are either accepting or rejecting potential of eternal existence. Mind is about all you have of universe reality that is subject to your will. And the soul, the Marantia self, will faithfully portray the harvest of the temporal decisions which the mortal self is making. Human consciousness rests gently upon the electrochemical mechanism below and delicately touches the spirit Marantia energy system above. Of neither of these two systems is the human being ever completely conscious in his mortal life. Therefore must he work in mind, of which he is conscious. And it is not so much what mind comprehends as what mind desires to comprehend that ensures survival. It is not so much what mind is like as what mind is striving to be like that constitutes spirit identification. It is not so much that man is conscious of God as that man yearns for God that results in universe ascension. What you are today is not so important as what you are becoming day by day and in eternity. Doesn't that, I mean, don't you just love how this book correlates and cross-references its material?
Yes.
That you could only do that if you had read and studied it, that you that it would call up something that encapsulates what you just read. And this is from paper 111, and you just read this in paper 9. What mind is, what mind does, the gift of the conjoint actor, and what it means to
just
you.
Just that comment that our mind is on loan. I mean, that alone is
it's on loan. Let's plug in.
It's
our
apparatus. Way, you know?
Apparatus. Yeah.
And implying that we'll have more apparati.
Apparatus.
I don't know if that's a word, but that our apparatus will improve, let's put it that way. And we'll be loaned an even better mind in the next life.
our transistor radio will receive.
Gone from a transistor radio to a smartphone.
and we'll transmit so much more beauty and truth and goodness through through that apparatus.
And those 70 senses, those will be fun.
Right. Well, we have all that in store. Well, thanks, you guys. What a wonderful discussion. I absolutely loved it. And Bob for joining us on the board. It was magical. Bob said, I don't even remember it was Saturday. Well, it's springtime. Everybody's out planting the garden. So there you go. Anyway, we love you guys. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with the Ministry of Mind. Wow. After this section, I can't wait.
Yeah,
that should
be good.
Can't wait for the Ministry of Mind. Hear, hear. Okay, my friends.
Love you
guys.
Have
a wonderful week.
Love
you, too.
Great week.
Yep, love you all.
Love you guys. Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.